Quick disclaimer, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are provided for informational purposes only and should not be construed as an offer to buy or sell any securities or to make or consider any investment or course of action. For more information, go to bestevershow.com.
If you do have a specific set of skills, to use a phrase, then leverage those skills and don't fear over leveraging in that particular area, because if you do have a good set of skills, that's going to overcome a lot of the other risks that you take by not being diversified.
Welcome to the Best Ever Show, the world's longest running daily commercial real estate podcast. Our hosts interview commercial real estate experts every day to get you the best advice ever with none of the fluffy stuff.
Best Ever listeners, welcome to the Best Real Estate Investing Advice Ever Show. I'm your host, Joe Cornwell, and today I'm joined by the great Jay Scott. Jay's obviously been on the show many times. I'm sure you're all familiar with him, so he needs no introduction, and I won't give you one this time. So, Jay, thank you for joining us again.
Hey, Joe. Thanks for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
So today, Jay and I are going to break down investment philosophy from Jay's perspective. This was a topic idea I've had for a while, and I thought no one better to suit this conversation than Jay. So Jay, again, thanks for joining us for this. So let's get into a very broad start where what is your investment philosophy? And I guess specifically, take me through how that's changed throughout your investing career.
Well, I've kind of had the same investing philosophy my whole life, but as I get more experience, it opens up more opportunities. So I haven't talked about this a lot, and I was excited to do this show because I get to talk about this topic for the first time. But in the business world, in the investing world, in everything that deals with money world, ventures, whether it's a real estate venture or a business venture, or you're buying artwork or you're buying whatever it is, I invest in a lot of different things. There's this thing known as a capitalization table. Or a cap table. And basically, this thing is the list of all of the people that have ownership in that deal. So if you're in the business world or the venture capital world, that's kind of where this comes from. All the people that own stock or shares in a business are listed on this capitalization table. And that might be the founders. They own stock, obviously, the investors. So friends and family investors and the venture capitalist investors and the angel investors, the employees, they own shares, maybe vendors. Maybe vendors are getting shares of the company in return for being able to provide things that you might need from a vendor. And so the cap table or the capitalization table is basically this list of all of the people that have any ownership whatsoever in a venture. And it lists how much ownership they have, what price they came in for, how much their equity is worth, et cetera, et cetera. And my general philosophy of investing throughout my life has been, I want to be on as many capitalization tables as possible. And that's really just a fancy way of saying, I want a little bit of ownership in as many things as I can get my hands on. Because as far as I'm concerned, diversification is huge. And my time is limited. I don't have the time to spend 20 hours on this venture and 20 hours on that venture and 20 hours on that venture. I'll run out of time very quickly. But if I can get a tiny piece of equity in a whole lot of different ventures, then presumably I get that diversification without spending more time than I actually have. So in my experience, there are three ways to get yourself on a cap table. There are three ways to earn equity in a venture. The first and probably the easiest is to buy your way on, to spend money. And we think of this as being a passive investor. So obviously most of your listeners are probably familiar with syndications. We have passive investors, or maybe you are a passive investor. And what you do is you turn your money over and you get equity in the deal. If the deal does well, you make money. If the deal does poorly, well, your money's at risk. But you don't spend any time. You are trading your money for equity in the deal. You get on the cap table by handing over some money. So that's the easiest way. But a lot of us, just like time, we don't have unlimited money to go around. And so the second way is to spend time. So if you don't have an unlimited amount of money, you can spend time to get on a cap table. Think of it as this is your sweat equity. You're trading your time for some piece of the pie for that venture. So let's say, Joe, you're putting together a syndication and you say, hey, Jay, I need somebody to come in and help me do underwriting on this deal. Or I need somebody to sign on the loan. Can you do that? And so I'll say, sure, I'll come in and I'll spend my time. And in return, you'll give me some amount of equity in the deal for my sweat equity, for my time, for the effort that I put in. It's very common in the tech world. I come from the tech world and I worked for a bunch of startup companies. And one of the big reasons people go to a startup company is because as an employee, you can get equity, you can get stock, you can get employee stock. So what you're doing is you're trading your time for some equity in the company. If the company ends up doing well, you make a lot of money. So the second way of getting on a cap table is to spend your time. So there's money, there's time. And then the third way is actually, I think, the most interesting. And this is the one that I've cultivated most over the last few years. But that's spending your knowledge to get on the cap table. So there are a lot of people out there that have ventures that need help. They need knowledge. They need somebody that can come in and teach them what they don't know or help them with some piece of the business from a knowledge standpoint that they don't have covered elsewhere internally. So, for example, I spend a lot of time doing advisory work for startup businesses. I focus on businesses in what's called the prop tech space. And prop tech is essentially startup tech businesses focused on real estate. So think of companies like Zillow or Airbnb or Redfin, but startup versions of those. So smaller versions of those. Founders that come in and say, hey, we're going to launch something that's going to do something similar maybe to one of those or something else in the real estate space, but we need help doing it. We need a consultant. For example, I was brought into a company about 10 years ago that has done tremendously well over the last 10 years. They're focused on essentially doing crowdfunding loans. And they needed somebody 10 years ago to come in and help them build their underwriting model and build their systems and processes around underwriting. So they brought me in for my knowledge in that area, and they gave me a piece of the business. And other companies have brought me in because I have a good network. I can introduce them to people, or I can teach them about some aspect of business. So I'm using my knowledge and my experience to get on the cap table. And my philosophy has always been, get on as many cap tables as I possibly can, even if it's a tiny little piece, even if I own 1% of a venture or a company, or a tenth of a percent of a venture or a company. Get on as many as I can, because that gives me diversification. It gives me profits, whether it be cash flow, whether it be tax benefits, whether it be any other type of profit from a lot of different places. I wake up in the morning and Warren Buffett's famous quote of, you're never going to be financially free unless you're making money while you sleep. I wake up in the morning and I might have some cash flow from this venture over here that I own 1% of. Maybe this business that I own 2% of got sold yesterday and now I'm going to get a check the next day. Maybe this real estate business that I own 5% of just did some depreciation. I'm going to get some tax benefits. So every day I wake up and I may not get a big check from any of these ventures, but on any given day, I may get a little money here, a little money there. I'm well diversified. And if any of those ventures end up hitting it big, if I haven't invested in the last Uber or Airbnb, but who knows, maybe one of those ventures that I own a tiny little piece in ends up going public for $1 billion or $50 billion or $1 trillion, and I make a nice return on, again, either my money, my time, or my knowledge.
Yeah, and there's so many things in there that we could pull out. One thing that you mentioned, and I don't know who said it, it was probably somebody on Shark Tank or something, but it was basically the idea where if you make a lot of bets, educated bets, let's call them, and you're wrong 500 times, you only have to be right once or twice or three times to get that big, massive reward. And again, I'm sure somebody has a better quote of that that I butchered. So that's one thing that came to mind when you were speaking. And then the other thing is that you mentioned at one point on one of your podcasts you're on where you were doing, I think it was like a daily growth that you wanted to basically grow your cash flow by day. I'm probably butchering this as well, but what is your philosophy on that? Because that kind of what came to mind when you were talking about all these things.
Yeah, 100%. And this kind of goes to the same piece. Let me reiterate one thing, because we often trade our time and our knowledge and our money for financial gain. But oftentimes we do it for one-time financial gain. I'll go to a job and I'll work 40 hours a week and I'll get a paycheck, or I will go and help out a real estate venture and they say, okay, I'll pay you $200 an hour for that. That's a one-time gain. And there's value there. If you're living paycheck to paycheck and you need to put food on your plate or a roof over your heads, then getting that paycheck is great. But we should all aspire to get to the point where instead of trading time, money, or knowledge for a one-time payment, that we're trading it for, again, equity in the deal, and we're getting a piece of the ownership. And maybe that translates to nothing. If a business goes under or a venture does poorly, then maybe that equity ends up being worth zero. But again, if it does well, we might get the recurring benefits in terms of cash flow or tax benefit or profits, and we might hit it big. So I just wanted to reiterate that I'm not just talking about working and getting paid for our time, money, and knowledge, but specifically getting this thing called equity, getting ownership, a piece of ownership. And so what you were asking about was a Facebook post I did probably about, it's got to be 7 or 8 years ago, and I repost it once a year because I think it's a good reminder, where I basically work through the math of, if you generate, and I don't remember the exact numbers I picked, but if you generate every day $1 or $10 a day of passive income, of cash flow, and every day you just focus on doing that. And again, you do it by putting in money, time, or knowledge. So day one, I go and I put $100 into a syndication, obviously. I'm probably not going to do $100, but let's say you put $100 into an investment that returns 10%. So now I'm making $10 per year, which translates to some amount of cash flow per day. And then the next day, I'm writing an ebook that I can put up on Amazon and I can sell. And if I sell a few copies a month, I'm generating another dollar or two or three a day. And then the next day I'm going out and I'm finding a real estate venture that needs some advice. And I say, I'll spend the day helping you. I'll spend 8 or 10 hours, but I want 0.5% of equity in that deal. And now that's generated some passive income, presumably for me, that I'll get in the future. Every day I'm focused on doing something that is going to add to my passive income. And if you do that, that passive income starts to compound. If you can add $10 a day over the course of a year, that's just under $4,000. But the next year, if you do the same thing, you're getting the compounding effect. So I'm getting the cash flow I generated last year, plus the cash flow I'm generating this year, and I'm getting a whole lot more, and I can reinvest that money. So basically, again, I don't remember the exact math. I'll have to dig up that post, but it was basically of doing just a dollar or two or $3 a day of additional cash flow. You can be retired in 5 or 10 years, and it takes a lot of work. Generating a dollar or two or five a day of cash flow isn't easy, but it gets your mind thinking about not just trading your time for money, but trading everything for equity that pays you over and over and over again.
Yeah, and I think, let's call it $4,000 a year. I think that is a realistically attainable metric. I think that's something that the average listener can take as a goal. And it's not so far-fetched that you have to be some wizard investor or guru or whatever. Just making reasonable investments, whether it's real estate, which is obviously our love and focus on the show, or other assets, that is something that the audience can attain. So knowing your story, knowing what I know of your story, you did a lot of flips for a lot of years. And so when I think about that, I ask myself, what was your mindset at that time when it came to investing? And the reason why I phrase it that way is because I think of flipping as creating active income, right? So certainly not a passive investment unless you really build out a big business. So walk me through your mindset at that time and then how it transitioned in the last, let's call it 10 or 15 years.
So let's be clear. If I had to do it over again, I would have done things differently. I flipped 400, 450 houses between 2008 and 2018, made a lot of cash, but I have a lot of regrets, and basically the number of regrets I have is equal to the number of houses that I flipped. If I look back, I wish I would have held every house that I flipped. Now, financially, I didn't have the means to hold 450 houses. I don't know if I even wanted to hold 450 houses, but what if I would have held one out of three, one out of four, one out of five? That's generating a lot of that cash flow that I'm sitting here talking about and telling you is that valuable. Instead, I was selling all of these houses. After I sell it, I then have to pay taxes. And then I have to find another investment that's generating a reasonable set of returns. So looking back, it's crazy the amount of money I spend in taxes and then had to reinvest that money when I had a perfectly viable, perfectly good investment sitting in front of me. But I couldn't imagine holding that investment because I was so focused on that pot of cash at the end of the deal. And so in retrospect, what I would say to anybody out there is there are two types of investments. There's the transactional and then there's the cash flow. And in real estate, that translates into there's buy and hold. You can buy rentals or you can do flips. And obviously, there's lots of permutations of both of those. But at the end of the day, any deal you're going to do is either going to be transactional, short term to generate a pot of cash, or it's going to be cash flowing, long-term to generate residual cash flow. And what I tell people is nothing wrong with doing the transactional. Again, sometimes we need to put food on our plate. We need to put a roof over our heads. We need to buy clothes and toys and stuff. So do the transactional to get you to the point where you can live your life. You can eat and you're clothed and housed, but then everything else, put that into cash flowing assets. don't sell more than you need to sell just because that big pot of cash looks so alluring at the end of the deal. Because the big thing that I've learned over the last 15 years is how much money can be lost to taxes and how much can be gained by either not paying those taxes, lowering those taxes, or even paying them and not lowering them, but deferring them for a few years. So what I tell everybody now is I regret most of those flips that I did because I didn't need that cash to live. And there was just no reason to pay taxes on it and then have to reinvest it when, again, I had a perfectly good investment already in front of me with the house I had bought.
At what point in that journey, do you recall, was there a aha moment during your years flipping in your timeline? Do you have a moment you were like, I need to get out of this and get into different investments?
Yeah, unfortunately, it was the other way around. I did take some of that money, invest in other things, but I look back and the amount of equity I left on the table was just staggering. I think at one point back in 2018 or 19, my wife and I did the math and we estimated that the 450 houses we sold, if we had kept them, and now obviously there was a big run-up between 2008 and 2018, we couldn't have predicted that and you're not always going to get those types of returns, but the money we left on the table was somewhere between 40 and 50 million by selling all of those houses, which is a significant amount of money. So it wasn't really until I did that math that I realized how badly I had messed up. But even after 2018, when we stopped flipping houses, what I realized was that I was keeping all of this money working and I had all of this money. I literally one day said, I can't do this anymore. I was burned out. I didn't want to flip houses anymore. We sold off everything. And all this cash that we had in all of these deals just started coming back to us. And I saw how much cash was sitting in a bank account. And I realized now I have to invest this capital. And I've paid already a ton of tax on this capital. I probably recycled that capital twice a year for the last 10 years. So I've basically paid tax at 15, 20, 25, 30% tax rate 20 times over on this capital when literally I could have just had that capital sitting in one good cash flowing investment forever and not have paid any tax whatsoever. So it was after I divested of all the single family stuff that I realized how much I had messed up. So I'm kind of in that mindset now that I just want to warn people. And trust me, I have no regrets flipping houses. It's a great way to make some income. Just don't take it overboard and don't ignore the fact that at some point you're going to want to retire. And to do that, you're going to need residual income.
Yeah. And one of my notes here was to talk about the ideology between active investing, let's call it, and passive investing. And like I said, flips are one of those where it depends on who you talk to, what they would classify that as. I look at flipping as more a business that generates revenue. And some people would call it an investment. So whatever, without splitting hairs. What are your thoughts on who should be active investing versus passive investing? And I guess we'll keep it within the confines of real estate here because that's probably the easiest one to dissect that on. Give me your thoughts on that. You can use your own personal example or hypothetical either way.
Let me step back because I want to address one thing really quick. And again, I'm the biggest proponent of flipping houses. I wrote a couple books on the topic. So I still want to sell books. So please go buy the books. But talking about whether flipping houses is investing or a business or something else, I would submit that it's neither of those. Investing is basically generating residual income. A business is something that you can potentially sell at the end of the day. Flipping is neither of those. Flipping isn't a way to generate residual income. Basically, it's going on eBay and buying something and reselling it. That's not investing. And that's what flipping houses is. And it's certainly not a business because, again, a business is something you grow with the ability for you to be able to step outside of it and then ultimately maybe be able to sell. I have met exactly one person that's ever figured out how to grow a flipping business to the point where they could run it without them being a part of it. And they could also sell it. They could sell the brand. There's one example, but I couldn't do it. I would guess that 99.9% of the people out there will never be able to build a flipping business that is something that they can either step out of day to day or that they can sell. So that means it's not a business. And if it's not a business, what is it? It's a job. So that leads us into your next question of active versus passive income. I'm a big proponent of you need both. You need to have your active investing strategy and you need to have your passive investing strategy. And the two don't need to be related. Too often I hear people say, I'm getting ready to jump into real estate. Should I start by flipping houses or buying rentals? And what I say is, That's apples to oranges. Flipping and buying rentals. One is an active strategy, one is a passive strategy. Do both or do neither, but don't compare the two. So we need a way to generate income, again, to put food on our plate, to put a roof over our heads, and then to have enough money to start investing in things that we can retire on. So that's the active side of things. And you need to figure out, when you're deciding what your active income is going to be, you need to figure out what the highest and best use of your time is. Where can you make the most money? And I would say that flipping houses, if you enjoy it, that's great. But if you can make 10 times as much money working a W-2 job or consulting or being an author and writing books or whatever it is, if you can make more money doing that than flipping houses, you should be doing the thing that you can make the most money at. Because your active income isn't the thing you're going to retire on. Your active income is the jet fuel that's going to get your plane to take off and get you to your retirement. So you need to be making as much money as quickly as possible through your active income, because again, that's limited. You only have a certain number of hours a day, you only have a certain number of days in the year, and you only have a certain number of years before you want to retire. So earn as much money as you possibly can every hour of your life while you're building up that active income. Now, after you build that active income, that's when you say, okay, I've got this pot of cash that I want to get residual income from. I want to get cash flow. I want to eventually be able to retire. And that's where you start thinking about your passive income strategies. And maybe that's cash flowing dividend stocks. Maybe that's investing in rental properties. Maybe that's investing in syndications. There are lots of different passive income opportunities out there. But think of that separately than your active income. So I tell everybody, first, figure out how you're going to make the most money per hour in your life. That should be your active income strategy. If it's flipping houses or wholesaling or something to do with real estate, great, do it. But if it's something outside of real estate, nothing wrong with that. And then figure out where you're going to take all that, hopefully huge pots of cash that you make, and figure out how you're going to invest it for residual income and ultimately for retirement.
So our next topic we're going to talk about here is asset types and asset investments. But before we get to that, I want your opinion on how much should the personal satisfaction or enjoyment of the way someone makes their active income factor into this journey, this path? And I'll give my thoughts, but I want to hear yours first.
Obviously, don't ever do anything you hate. In fact, don't ever do anything that you're going to look back on your deathbed or in 30 years or 50 years and say, I wish I wouldn't have done that. I guess I'm assuming, most things being equal, if you have to choose between working a job or flipping houses, if they're going to provide equal satisfaction or relatively equal satisfaction, the only difference being one feels like it's less of a job because you're sort of controlling your own hours versus the other one feeling more of a job because you do have a boss. If the one that has a boss pays a whole lot more money, consider it. Don't necessarily jump into real estate because you feel like it's cool or you're doing it for the wrong reasons. Because again, I'm a big believer that active income, you want to be doing that as little time in your life as possible. And if I can make twice as much doing A than I can doing B, well, I'd rather do A because then I can stop doing it in half as much time.
And that's exactly my point that I would make. Maybe this is a disagreement, but I don't know if I think enjoyment is as big of a factor as most people would consider. And the reason why I say that is because the people who I know who reach financial freedom really quickly usually were miserable. And that's a massive motivating factor. And I'm not saying that that's necessarily healthy. Even my journey probably wasn't healthy, but it's a real driver. It's a real motivator when you have to do 5 or 10 years of something that hopefully is high income, as you mentioned, but you really don't like it. And almost every day you go in, how can I find my way out of this path? I think finding motivation obviously comes in a lot of forms, but hating your job or hating your career could be one of them. So obviously I say that with caution, but I don't think you have to love every day of what you're doing. You don't necessarily have to be happy doing what you do every day. Let's look back at our parents and our grandparents' generation. I don't know any of them that enjoyed what they were doing every day. Just a different mindset. It was like, this is my job. This is my career. I get up every day. I do hard stuff. I go to bed. And it's, I think the last couple generations have completely delineated from that mindset. And maybe that's a good thing. I don't know.
if you can do something that you love that makes you close to the amount of money that you could make doing something you hate, the answer is obvious. But again, if you can get out of it, the question is, think about 10 years from now. If you could look back and say, okay, I would have been happy working a crappier job for the last 10 years to be done today. Think that right now. Everybody sit here and say, if for the last 10 years I was working a job that's not very fun and a lot crappier than whatever I'm doing, but I could be done today, would you have traded that for what you did for the last 10 years knowing you have to do it for another 10 or 20?
Yeah, I would. And here's the real problem. I talk to a ton of newer investors or people just getting into investing, and how many of them have jobs or careers they hate and they don't pay well, right? So it's the worst of both worlds. So to me, that's the type of person who maybe there is an argument for them and their personal situation to go out and start a wholesaling business or do a flipping, whatever you want to call it. Because now, even if you are equally as unsatisfied, you now have the potential to make a lot more income than, let's say, if you're a teacher and you hate teaching and you're making $40,000 a year. There's no upside in staying in that career path. Okay, so when we talk about the passive investments, or even let's say semi-active, maybe you do have some role that requires time or bandwidth to get into it. How should people look at different asset types, or how do you look at different asset types? And then I guess the second part of that is, how do you diversify just within real estate of itself? So first, looking at broadly other asset types, and then the diversity within real estate.
I think it has to evolve. We go through stages in our life. When we're younger, we have more time. We have more energy. Before we have a family, obviously, we have a lot more time. And speaking for myself, a whole lot more energy. Then you have a family and you want to spend a little bit less time working and more time with the family, but you're still willing to do some work. And then at some point, you get to the point where I don't want to be working at all, or I want to be working minimally. And eventually you want to retire completely. That's the way most people feel. And you have to match up where you are in your life and where you are in your needs for the types of returns that you're getting. If we look at real estate, and I think this translates well to most investment asset classes, there are essentially four types of returns that we're generating. One, we're generating cash flow. Two, we're generating some amount of profit. So again, think of it transactionally. You buy something and it's worth more at some point. You sell it and you make a bunch of money. Number three, you're getting tax benefits, which again, I think is often underrated and not appreciated by a lot of us until we get older and recognize how much we're losing to taxes. And then number four, and this might be more exclusive to real estate, but we're getting this thing called amortization or principal pay down. So when we own an asset that has debt and we have somebody else paying off that debt, we're gaining equity every day that somebody else is paying off that debt. So at different points in your life, you're going to want and need different types of returns. So for me, when I'm making a lot of money flipping houses, I don't care about cash flow because I have enough money from the flipping houses that I can live off of that. So 15 years ago, cash flow would have been less important to me, but I really wanted that back end profit. I wanted to know that in 5 or 10 or 20 years, I was going to get a big pot of cash for something I invested in. I really like the amortization, the loan pay down, because I didn't need the cash today, but knowing that I could have an asset that in 20 or 30 years is completely paid off and starts generating a lot of cash flow for me, that's great. Tax benefits. I didn't realize it back then, but I probably needed a lot more tax benefits. I probably wanted a lot more tax benefits. So that was important to me back then because I was generating a lot of cash from my flipping houses. So at that point, I didn't need the cash flow. What I should have cared about was the tax benefits, the appreciation, and the amortization, the loan pay down. Now, here we are 15 years later. I have a family. I don't want to be working 80 hours a week, and I'm not flipping houses anymore. I'm doing syndications where I may not get a payoff for 3 or 5 years, or the way the economy is, maybe even longer than that. So if I want to be able to generate income day to day, I need to be making some cash flow these days. So I need more cash flow today than I needed 15 years ago. So my investment strategy should be focused on less appreciation, maybe less tax benefits, maybe less amortization, and a little bit more cash flow. So I have to make those adjustments so that I'm moving returns from one category that I don't need anymore to a category I do need. And then 15 years from now, I probably won't want to be working at all. And I'm not going to care about the tax benefits at all because I'm not going to be making a ton of money. Or at least not outside of cash flow. I'm not going to care as much about the amortization because I will have wanted to have captured that equity. I'm going to care about the cash flow. So 15 years from now, I'm going to want everything to move into the cash flow bucket. So you need to be thinking in terms of today, what are those specific types of returns you need to live the life you want to live and to set yourself up for whatever the next phase is. And you need to be thinking about what that next phase is, and you need to be diversifying and changing your investment strategy over the years so that you're getting the types of returns you're going to need in the future. So just a more tangible example is, right now, I'm not going to lock myself into a syndication that's a 10 or 15 year syndication. So we see a lot of deals these days that actually look pretty attractive. 15 years ago, I would have loved to have been in a syndication that was going to return a 20% IRR over 15 years, because I wouldn't have had to think about that money. I wouldn't have had to pay taxes on it for 15 years. Well, right now, I need to be more liquid than that in the next 10 to 15 years. So I'm not going to focus on that. I'm going to focus on things that are generating more cash flow. I'm not going to focus on as many advisory roles, things where I'm getting equity in return for my knowledge, because it could be 5 or 10 or 15 years before those companies get sold or go public and I can make any money. I'm going to focus more on the cash flow stuff. So everybody needs to be figuring out where they are in life, what types of returns they're going to need to live, and then diversify across assets that generate those specific types of returns.
We'll get back to the show, but first, some sponsors I'm confident you'll find value in learning more about. If you're an investor like me, you're probably looking for one platform to manage the banking and finance needs of your entire portfolio. The good news is there is one. It's called Baselane, and it's the number one banking platform built for independent real estate investors that reduces busy work so you can focus on growing your business. With Baselane, you can earn up to a 4.19% annual percentage yield and 5% cash back on debit card spending with no monthly fees. With a simplified view of your cash flow and expenses, you can retire those tedious spreadsheets. You can also manage unlimited virtual accounts and cards, and even open separate accounts for each property or unit. Join more than 40,000 real estate investors who trust Baselane for their banking, property management, and bookkeeping. Head over to baselane.com/Joe and sign up today for a chance to win a $500 Amazon gift card. That's baselane.com/Joe. Are you raising capital for commercial real estate ventures? To make sure you comply with security laws and structure your deals correctly, talk to syndicationattorneys.com, your premier legal resource for real estate syndicators and fund managers. Syndicationattorneys.com dedicates its practice to helping real estate syndicators and fund managers legally raise capital from private investors. Their experienced team has helped create over $2.75 billion in security offerings, making them industry leaders in the capital raising space. To get a free copy of their book, How to Raise Capital for Real Estate Legally, go to syndicationattorneys.com or text the word FAIRLESS to 844-796-3428. That's FAIRLESS, FAIRLESS, to 844-796-3428. Launch and grow your business with syndicationattorneys.com today. This offer is not valid to Florida residents.
I guess one personal question I have, and something that I thought about in the lines of this conversation, is when I started my real estate journey 8 years ago, started buying small multifamily properties. Everybody's goal is to get to that 1 million net worth for whatever reason. That's always a tangible goal that people strive for. And the more I learned is that people typically, when they go from 1 million in net worth to, let's say, 10 million, okay, just using two kind of benchmarks, is that it's usually not all through just real estate investments. So my question is, when you were in your journey in creating wealth, creating financial freedom, investing in all the things you've done, at what point did you get more interested or broaden your horizons to, let's say, as you mentioned, doing some angel investing or maybe even investing in a small business or something like that? Because those are some of the things I'm looking at, but I am curious to see if my mindset and my focus is going down the right path or not.
People are surprised to hear this, but I'm a shiny object syndrome kind of guy. I like to do different things. I get bored very easily. But one of the things I've recognized, forced myself to do, and would encourage everybody else to do, is to really learn how to focus as much as you possibly can on one task, one goal, one whatever it is you're working on, until you've gotten to, like, you're in the top 10% of the world at being good at that thing. I'm a big fan of the 80-20 rule, so maybe I should say get to the top 80%. And once you've gotten there, then move on to the next thing. So too many people have this extreme to one end or the other. They'll either say, you need to focus your entire life on one thing to make billions of dollars. Go the Warren Buffett or the Bill Gates route, where you have one venture or one type of business or one business model that's your whole life. And that's probably the best way to make $1 billion or $5 billion. Or we have people that go the other way, which is, I want to be doing 20 different things tomorrow. They think that they can be Elon Musk. I can run a SpaceX company and Tesla and PayPal and Twitter and all of these other companies all at once. But what they don't realize is Elon Musk got there by focusing on one business for many, many years, made enough money that he can now go out and do that. And so there are people that want to do 30 different things at once. So what I found is if you're at one extreme, you only focus on one thing and you do it your entire life, you have the highest chance of making literally billions of dollars. If you're at the other extreme where you want to do 10 different things all at the same time, learn them all at the same time, feel like, oh, I can just bring in partners and managers and other people that can help me do this. What I found is those people tend to make zero. So you need to figure out where you are on that spectrum. And as somebody with shiny object syndrome, I'm never going to be at the side of the spectrum where I'm going to focus on one thing my whole life. So I've accepted I'm never going to be a billionaire. But I've also recognized that I need to harness my shiny object syndrome. I need to avoid it. I need to learn how to focus so that I'm not on the other extreme either. So at any given time, I'm modulating how much I am enjoying doing what I'm doing by doing multiple things. But I recognize that if I try and do three different things right now, or if I try and do something and move on too quickly, that I'm not ever going to get as far along in my gaining wealth path as I otherwise was. So everybody needs to decide, what's your trade-off? Are you willing to trade off some money to do things that are more fun and diverse? Or do you just really want to make a lot of money? And if so, you just need to focus. So everybody needs to figure out where they're willing to be on that continuum. I know how much money I want to make, so I know how much fun I can have and still be able to make that money. But I'm never going to make much more because I'm not willing to focus more than that.
So that's great advice. And yeah, I probably similar fall in the middle of that spectrum where I do get distracted. I love the idea of different types of investments, different type of businesses. I operate two businesses of my own already. So probably doesn't make sense to go out and pay for more businesses that I need to potentially operate or even contribute some of my bandwidth to. It's probably not the smartest thing, but it seems really appealing.
Yeah, I was reading a Facebook post this morning. Somebody on my feed was talking about how they wanted to do the Elon Musk model, or I think they were talking about Richard Branson, which is kind of the same model. Start lots of companies, bring in partners, bring in managers, and this person doesn't have a lot of money right now, and they think that they can do 10 different businesses at once if they just structure things the right way. And again, they use Richard Branson as the example. I see people use Elon Musk as the example. But what they don't realize is, yeah, those people are billionaires right now, but they didn't start branching out into all of these businesses until they had hundreds of millions of dollars. And they got to the tens or the hundreds of millions of dollars by focusing on one thing. And so don't lose sight of the fact that these people didn't come out of the womb saying, okay, I'm broke, but I'm going to start 10 businesses and become a billionaire. They didn't. They focused on one business for a long time. They made their tens or hundreds of millions of dollars. And then those tens or hundreds of millions of dollars gave them the ammunition to go and try different things. And if they lose 10 million here, 20 million there, they'll recover from it because they'll make a lot in somewhere else. So if you don't have 10 or $50 million, don't think you're going to fall into that category.
No, that's great advice. And your point you just made there reminds me of the last couple of things here on my list I want to cover before we run out of time. So one of the topics I want to talk about was asymmetric bets. So can you define that for the audience, what it means to you, and then how you apply that in your philosophy?
Yeah. So an asymmetric bet, or sometimes we call it asymmetric risk reward, it's basically a situation where you're in an investment that offers you a bigger upside reward potential than it does offer you downside risk. Just using an example, let's say I said, let's play an imaginary game where we flip a coin and I tell you that you call heads or tails. If you get it correct, I'm going to give you $10. If you get it wrong, you're only going to lose $9. How many times would you flip that coin?
I guess you could do it forever. Eventually, you're going to win, right?
You do it forever because it's an asymmetric bet. Basically, you win more when you win than you lose when you lose. And those are the types of investments that we want to look for. We want to look for investments that have more potential upside if they go well than downside based on the risk potential. The way we get that asymmetric win potential is through doing investments where we have some competitive edge, and that competitive edge is normally knowledge. So let's say I had the opportunity to invest with two investors. Both of them are offering an investment in a multifamily syndication, same location, same type of deal, same everything, except one person's done 30 of those deals before, the other person's done two of those deals before. All other things being equal, you're going to get a positive asymmetric risk reward by investing with the person that's done 30 of those deals than the person that's done two deals. Because it's basically the same bet you're making, you're investing in the same thing, but in one, you have more experience by the person that you're investing with.
All right, let me flip that hypothetical just because I want to see what your thoughts are. Let's say you're making $100,000 passive investment in the experienced operator and you're going to get 10%. But let's say the less experienced operator for $100,000 passive investment, you're going to get 25%. How would you look at that?
Putting numbers down on a piece of paper, and we actually can, and I wrote a book called Real Estate by the Numbers where I talk about some ways that we can literally map out which of those is a better investment. There's this thing called expected value, and we can do this expected value equation where we can assign probabilities to making money and how much we would make under each of those situations, and we can do the math. So that's what I would suggest in that situation. If they're not 100% equal other than knowledge, then you have to run some scenarios and you need to say, well, there's X percent chance of this one going well versus failing, X percent chance of this one going well versus failing. How much am I going to make if for each of them? And then use an expected value equation to map that out. So that's the best way to mathematically determine if something is a positive risk reward or not. But the simplest way is you look at two similar investments and you go with the person that's most experienced. But it's not the only way to generate positive risk reward. So another way is just using historical analysis. A lot of times we have the opportunity to invest in either one asset class or another, or within an asset class, we can invest in one location or another. Lots of different permutations there. But what I like to do is I like to look historically. How does this asset class compare to this asset class? How does this location compare to this location? Obviously, we do that with operators. We say which operators have the most experience and the best track record. So just by going with historical results, all other things being equal, you're going to get better risk reward. You're going to get a better asymmetric risk by doing the thing that historically has worked out well. It's one of the reasons why I invest in multifamily right now. There are a lot of great asset classes out there. There are a lot of asset classes I would love to invest in that I think will probably do well over the next several years. But historically, I think multifamily has been the best risk-adjusted returns of any asset class on the planet. So all other things being equal, I'm going to put history to work and I'm going to say this is the asset class I prefer to be in.
And that was literally my last question. How are you viewing the market we're in today for diversifying real estate? And so obviously you mentioned diversifying, let's say you're an LP investor, diversifying operators, diversifying markets, diversifying asset classes. How do you weigh those three things? And you gave us a lot of your opinion on that right there, but how would you suggest our audience weigh the three of those or use the three of those to diversify just within real estate itself as one overall asset?
What are the three you listed again?
Potentially operators if you're doing a passive investment, markets, and asset type. So let's say commercial or flex industrial or multifamily or single family, whatever, all the different real estate classes.
It's really hard to say which of those is more important. I think they're all equally important because they're all levels of diversification, asset classes. We have a lot of cross correlations and positive and negative correlations, meaning if one asset class does well, it means that other asset classes might tend to do less well and vice versa. So anytime we diversify, what we're doing is we're spreading risk. It means less risk, but generally less returns. So that's what we want to do during times of economic turmoil. We're willing to accept lower returns, or at least most of us are, for less risk. And so investing across asset classes is obviously important because you get these negative correlations or these cross correlations that if something does bad, something else is probably going to do well. Same thing with operators. My issue with operators is I don't have an issue with saying this operator has been great historically, so I would invest a lot of money with that operator. I don't diversify across operators because I'm concerned one operator is not as good as I think he is or she is. It's more that a single operator typically doesn't provide a lot of diversification. So if I invest with an operator who is great at multifamily, I'm going to get a lot of multifamily. I'm not going to get the other asset classes or the other locations. If I invest with an operator that tries to do everything, well, then we go back to the other issue of not focusing. So diversification across operators is really important because that offers you diversification across all the other things. And then for me, location diversification is more of a catastrophic risk mitigation. I'm less concerned about Cincinnati is going to do a little bit better than Omaha, Nebraska, and so I want to be diversified. I'm more concerned about if I invest in Florida, what happens if there's a major hurricane, a property gets wiped out, and now it becomes uninsurable because all the insurers move out of the state. And we're seeing this in Florida. We're seeing insurers move out of the state because there's been a lot of hurricanes. So I don't want to put all my eggs in the Florida basket. And likewise, another location might have risk of catastrophic economic risk. So for example, if we see a recession, 2008, we saw that tourism got absolutely crushed. So if you invested in a Las Vegas or an LA or an Orlando, Florida, those places got crushed because of the economic conditions. So you put all your eggs in one basket and then there's some economic situation. Let's say oil collapses. I don't want all my investments to be the energy corridor in Houston. So diversifying across locations is important. But I'm going to add a couple more to that because here are some things that I think are just as important to diversify across. I like to diversify across places in the capital stack. And what I mean by that is a lot of us are used to investing as regular passive investors, equity investors in deals, which means we get paid last. When a deal makes money every month, the first person that gets paid is the lender. Lender gets paid, then there might be somewhere in the middle other people that get paid, people called mezz debt providers or preferred equity providers. Then after everybody else gets paid, if there's money left over, we get paid last as regular equity investors. Well, obviously the safer position is to get paid first or second or third, not to get paid last. We might get lower returns. The lender's going to get lower returns than the passive investors when everything goes well, but they're in a lot safer position. And so I like to invest in other parts of the capital stack. I like to invest in debt. I like to invest in preferred equity. So again, I'm going to have lower returns, but I'm going to have less risk. So that's another diversification technique. Another diversification technique is going to be exit strategy. So I might just invest in multifamily, but doesn't mean I have to invest in one type of multifamily. Maybe I'm invested in stabilized multifamily. So assets that are just generating 4, 5, 6% cap rate, they're fully leased up, there's no renovation that's needed, great. Maybe I invest in value-add multifamily where we're going in and we're doing renovations and we're improving management and we're generating some appreciation from that. Different risk profile. So even though it's in the same asset class, I'm going to get a different set of risks. I'm going to get some diversification. And the next level of that, maybe I'm going to invest in new construction multifamily. Again, different risk profile, but it's not necessarily going to be directly correlated to value add or stabilize. So investing across different exit strategies. And then finally, timeframes. I'm a big fan of investing across timeframes. Deals that say they're going to return 20% IRR in a year tend to have a much different risk profile than deals that say they're going to return 20% IRR in 10 years. And so diversifying across exit timelines allows me to change my risk profile. And again, that's the whole point of diversification, is we want to provide lots of different risk profiles in our portfolio so that if one bad thing happens, hopefully it's canceled out by something good happening.
Yeah, and I know you've mentioned this before, and I know we're running up on time, but it sounds like from when I've heard you speak that real estate is still predominantly your investment vehicle. Obviously different types, but you're not putting huge percentages of cash or net worth into other different asset types.
Yep. For the most part, yes, I'm heavily invested in real estate and I'm a big fan of invest what you know. If you're not an expert in something, diversify and let other really smart people control your money for you. But if you do have a specific set of skills, to use a phrase, then leverage those skills and don't fear over leveraging in that particular area, because if you do have a good set of skills, that's going to overcome a lot of the other risks that you take by not being diversified. So yeah, a lot of my money goes into real estate. I have a lot of money in tech investments. So again, specifically prop tech, so real estate technology companies, because it's an area that I know well. I know technology well, I know real estate well. So I believe that, to go back to the term asymmetric risk, I think that my asymmetric risk is better in that asset class because I can analyze businesses better than most people can in that asset class. And I think my upside is bigger than my downside. So those are the two big areas that I invest in. I invest in some other more esoteric things. I own a bunch of racehorses, more because it's fun than anything. I certainly don't recommend anybody out there raise horses. I invest in some syndications that buy art and things like that, more because I enjoy learning new areas. But it's a very small percentage. I do some crypto investing and crypto company investments and things like that. But again, that's more gambling than anything. Focus on the areas that you really know well, because again, it goes back to that great question about asymmetric risk.
Yeah. And my final thoughts are that all of the investors I've talked to over the years, you have these levels that everyone strives to. And we talked about that. You have benchmarks of cash flow, you have benchmarks of net worth, income, all of those things. And as you get higher and higher up the chain and you reach your goals, that obviously allows you to take more risk that you wouldn't have taken 5 or 10 years ago. So obviously for the audience listening to this, it may not be there yet, but one day if you continue doing the right things and invest in those things you do know and understand, you'll be in a position where you can buy racehorses or invest in art, some of these more abstract type of investments that, as you mentioned, you probably don't have a whole lot of direct control over.
Yeah, I'm a big fan. Take 5% of your portfolio and do something fun with it. And the cool thing is, a lot of us, when we say do something fun with it, people talk about, oh, buy a car, buy some other big expensive toy. What I'm saying is gamble with it in an investment where, yeah, maybe you'll throw that money away the same way as if you bought a depreciating car, but maybe you'll hit the jackpot and you'll make a lot of money. So I'm a big fan of taking a few percent of your portfolio and just put it in stuff that you want to learn about or you think would be fun to invest in and have fun with it.
Well, Jay, I appreciate all your insights. It's been an amazing conversation. Covered my whole long list of questions, so I really appreciate the time. We'll skip the lightning round this time. I know you did it with me not too long ago, so we'll skip that for today. My last question is, what is this apartment attics thing I've been seeing you talk about, and where can people learn more about it?
Appreciate you asking. And let me just say, this has been a fun conversation. It's very rare that I jump on an interview and get to talk about things in 15 years I've never talked about. And I'm sitting here, my mind's racing, thinking of all the things I could have said and should have said. So thank you for making this a really fun interview. Apartment Addicts, we have a multifamily coaching group, my partner Ashley Wilson and I. And basically, we teach aspiring multifamily investors how to invest in multifamily. And so if anybody that wants more information, go to joinaa.com. So Apartment Addicts, joinaa.com. And would love to chat with you. So thanks for...
Not the other AA.
The
fun one, yeah.
We do have a 12-step program, but it's 12 steps to learning multifamily, not the other 12 steps.
That's awesome. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Glad you enjoyed the conversation as well. And looking forward to the next one.
Thanks so much, Joe.
Best ever listeners, if you got value from today's show, be sure to share this with someone who may enjoy it. Make sure you are subscribed and follow the podcast so you don't miss anything. Thank you all for sticking it out with our longer episode today, and I hope you all have a best ever day.
Hi, best ever listeners. Joe Fairless here again. And one last thing before you go, would you like to receive a short weekly email with proven tips from experienced investors, free tools and resources, and a roundup of the week's most relevant news and best ever content? Well, if so, join the community of nearly 15,000 commercial real estate passive and active investors who receive the best ever newsletter. Just go to bestevercre.com/access and you'll get the very next one. I hope you enjoyed this episode. And as always, thank you for listening and have a best ever day.